Chibop, my baby. Chibop, chibop.
Hello, stranger.
All right. The song that you're hearing right now is actually instrumental. It's not as an instrumental, but it's an instrumental in the movie that we're about to talk about. I should first of all say there's no comedy intro today because I sort of couldn't figure out. I mean, not that the movie or anything else we're going to talk about today is horribly somber or any more somber anyway than most of the things that we talk about and do comedy intros for. I just couldn't find a way in somehow. I don't know. There's some way in which the movie that we're about to talk about, which is called Moonlight, is so perfect in what it is that it's kind of hard to do a gloss on it anyway. It would feel like sacrilege, at least to me. Anyway, that may not be the case for all the guests, although I kind of happen to know it is. Tom Breen is the film critic for the New Haven Independent and the host of Deep Focus. I've got a new way of saying it.
There are six E's in that, so yeah, that was pronounced correctly.
You need somebody with an even deeper voice to say that, though. Welcome to Deep Focus.
Are we recording this? Can I? Okay.
Yeah, on WNHH. Lucy Gelman is a reporter for the New Haven Independent and station manager at WNHH. And Sean Murray, making his debut on the nose, is a stand-up comedian based in New Haven. And we're excited to have him with us today. We are going to talk about Moonlight. Moonlight is a movie that tells essentially three stages in the life of a young gay man, growing up from boy to man, poor in Miami, here's one of the problems that we have with clips from this is there are very few movies that use silences as effectively as this movie does, and the protagonist is notoriously within the movie a man of very few words. After being a boy of very few words. So you're going to have here a scene. This actually involves the protagonist's mother. The protagonist's name is Chiron. You're going to hear his mother talking to a man named Juan. Juan is kind of a mid-level drug dealer, but he has a heart of gold. He has noticed that nobody's really kind of taking care of this boy. The mother has a drug problem. The boy is being harassed by other boys who seem to have already somehow or other detected his sexual orientation. And so you're going to hear his mother, played by Naomi Harris, who I believe is Miss Moneypenny now in the Bond movies, talking to this man who kind of out of nowhere has taken a temporary interest in her son.
What happened? Huh? What happened, Chiron? Why you didn't come home like you're supposed to? Huh? And who is you?
Nobody. I found him yesterday. Found him in a hole on 15. Yeah, that one. Some boys chased him in the cut. He's scared more than anything. He wouldn't tell me where he lived till this morning.
Well, thanks for seeing to him. He usually can take care of himself. Good that way, but...
Little man.
All right, so let's start with our film critic. This movie was made for, I think, very little money. The director would be happy to tell you that it was made for very little money, based on an idea that existed within a play. We'll tell you a little bit more about the man who wrote the play because he has some significance here to where we are right now. It doesn't have any really major stars in it, although I think we might be seeing the Janelle Monáe movie career get kicked off. I know she's going to be in Hidden Figures early next year. But somehow or other, Tom, this movie has really gotten the attention it deserves. It's suddenly part of a lot of big conversations about best movies of the year.
So I think there are a number of reasons why this movie has gotten so much attention, and also a number of reasons, maybe the same, maybe slightly different, of why it is such an incredible achievement and such a great work of art. And during our email thread before the nose, we were talking about how can we convince a hypothetical viewer, for instance, Jonathan's mom, that this is a life-changing movie, that this isn't just a representation of a story that isn't often told in mainstream American culture, but it's actually an exemplary one. And I think the true, maybe artistic achievement of this movie first is the way that it grapples with this concept of double consciousness. And that is the idea that kind of articulated by W.E.B. Du Bois at the turn of the century, but it's something that I think many minorities have grappled with throughout the history of America, which is the two kind of identities of who you are, who you feel yourself to be, and who you present as based on what other people expect from you. Here we have a taciturn, incredibly sensitive young man who also, you know, admires a hard kind of the guy that runs the streets, the drug dealer Juan, who is, yeah, maybe he, you know, on paper that character may read like a stereotype and a drug dealer with a heart of gold, but there's such delicacy given to the description of each of these characters that they really emerge above any kind of stereotypical depiction. And what this movie takes, you know, it takes this idea of double consciousness, the conflict of multiple identities, and it shows moments of reconciliation in the moonlight, on the beach, by the waves, when these two identities allied into something that isn't just kind of painful and rife with conflict, but actually, you know, about intimate connection. And I think that's something very rare in depicting both vulnerability and kind of authentic connection between people.
Well, rather than asking each of you pointed questions, although since Sean's the newest person here, we thought about making him pretend that he hated the movie just so that, because, you know, like, you know, but I knew everybody really liked this movie a lot. So I'm just going to ask each of you, starting with you, Lucy, what you know, because you pointed out correctly in the email, we probably all liked it differently. What did you love about it?
Oh, I mean, I love that this movie, its strength, and it has many incredible strengths, but its most pronounced strength is that it operates in nuance and understatement. Colin, you were talking about the importance of silence, and I don't think one can sort of talk about that point enough. So silence, and then also speech, when it is used, it's used very economically at times, and gesture. And the sort of the coherence of gesture between young Chiron and older Chiron, as well as middle Chiron, to tell this very this story that is supposed to be unextraordinary, and I think becomes touching in the way that it is told to be unextraordinary, and just to say, hey, this is one portrait of one person throughout several years of his life. Really stuck with me. And I think this was something that I saw and said, I wasn't as blown away as maybe I thought I was going to be, but here I am 72 hours later, and I'm still thinking about it very much in vivid
color. Yeah.
Sean? I like the subtlety of it. It does a great job of like the show and not telling thing that you're always supposed to do in like that type of art. Like, I was listening to an interview with Barry Jenkins, the director, and he was telling a story about the guy Juan's character is based off is a guy, similar guy in his life named Blue, who he took that same role, like he was a drug dealer, but he took him in. And then one weekend he went away with his real father and he came back and Blue was dead. And that's kind of how they do it in the movie, where it's like you don't know that Juan's character has passed away until much later. Like, they cut to the next stage of Chiron's life, and then you just find out. And it's like, it kind of has a deeper impact than if you just, like, they didn't have to have a scene where he's gunned down or whatever. You don't even need to know how it happened. You just know that he's gone. And, like, just him walking into Janelle Monáe's character's house and, like, he's not there. And you kind of wonder, like, where is Juan? And then it kind of comes out, like, it's kind of fed to you a little slower than it would normally be. I think that's so subtle. And then, like, just the performances are so, like Lucy was saying, so much of it is not spoken. It's just, like, the camera shows it all. Like, even like the introduction of Juan, you learn he's the, like, the top guy in the streets just from the scene. No one ever says, like, Juan, no one ever said that about him. Like, when the opening scene, he just goes to the block and he's talking to his, like, lieutenant, and you can tell that he has control of all of that without them ever having this. No one has to have to say, like, oh, Juan's the guy and the top dog. It's just like, you just know it. I think it's so amazing. And then, like, the casting, like, they said they never tried to cast based on appearance, but it's just perfect. Like, that there's that poster where it's the three slices of each all their faces. Mm-hmm. It's like they're so well casted, and like for each stage of his life, it's amazing.
Yeah, I saw it with a group of or with two other people, and one of the people who, as we walked out, said, "This is one of those movies that prove that casting directors should get Academy Awards. It is so immaculately cast." And it is very interesting. Since you mentioned the scene where, in fact, so once again, to sort of set this up a little bit, and we're trying not to spoil anything. I don't think it'd be kind of hard to spoil things in this movie. It's really not that kind of movie, but I'm trying not to spoil things. But there is a scene where the sort of the middle version of this character, Chiron, shows up at the one house where he's ever really kind of been taken care of. Paradoxically, it's the house of this guy, Juan, this kind of hard but kind drug dealer. His significant other is played by Janelle Monáe. You hear her interacting in the way that Sean is talking about with young, but not quite so young, Chiron.
All right. Water for me and a little gin for you. Boy, please. I know Wine used to give you that gin, but we ain't doing that up in here, shouted. You don't think my joke was funny? What's wrong?
Nothing. I'm good.
No. I didn't seem good. And you ain't it. And stop putting your head down in my house. You know my rule. It's all love and all pride in this house. You feel me? I can't hear you. Do you feel me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I feel you.
All right.
All right, that's also from Moonlight. Tom, one thing that I want to see this movie again just for technique. Not that I'm a big technique maven, but, you know, Barry Jenkins works with a camera guy, with a cinematographer. I think he's known since college or film school or something like that. Whatever their collaboration is like, it's remarkable. There are ways in which I think we've all gotten kind of annoyed with handheld cameras. But here they're used. One of the early scenes is this kind of jittery chase where the young Chiron is being chased by his tormentors. The use of the handheld camera there, it's just amazing. It really kind of recreates the motion. There's another moment where he's kind of being circled by his chief tormentor, a guy named Tyrell, where the camera just moves quickly in the circle, and we're just, once again, we're kind of, you know, we're experiencing probably the panicky gaze of the person who's going to be the subject of the object of the violence. There's a scene where he's being taught to swim, where the water is just used so amazingly. Water is also used amazingly in this completely heartrending scene where little Chiron, he's known as Little, is boiling a pot of water. I think this comes right from Barry Jenkins' life, too. Both of the two people who created this grew up, I think, in the same projects in Miami. He's boiling this huge pot of water that he's going to add to bath water so they can have a hot bath. And then suddenly the camera also just lingers on him, and he's got the suds are kind of, you know, up around his hair and his eye. He looks like an old man. There's like a statue of an old man sitting in this tub. And it's these Edward Hopper type scenes of this diner that sort of makes up the kind of the last set of images from the movie. I don't know, Tom, there's just an incredible beauty amid the poverty of this movie.
So if I may identify one more kind of signature camera move in this movie before talking about the effect of the technique, is these tracking shots in which the camera is following Chiron or Black or Little from behind as he's walking to kind of initiate a pretty momentous encounter in whatever scene we're in. In the middle section, it's a pretty violent encounter in which we see him entering a school and having a pretty serious confrontation with a bully. And in the final sequence, in the diner sequence, we follow him as he approaches the diner where his lover from 10 years ago is now working as the cook. The camera does the exact same move. We remember the anger and the incredible physicality of the motion that led to the smashing of the chair behind someone's back. But instead, we're taken to a moment of incredible tenderness, a moment of reconnection of characters. And that is what, I mean, we can't talk, yes, there's, you know, certainly it's easy to be fatigued by conspicuous camera movements, but I don't want to get to a place where I ever like talk about a movie or a work of art without considering the form in addition to the content. And this is such a beautiful kind of conjunction of form and content, and that we get the camera, kind of recurring camera movements, camera placements, telling us something about the identity of this character. And the way that they're repeated through the sections gives audiences and encourages them to be perceptive. You have to be attentive to every single little thing that's going on. We only seen Little give a big smile once, and that's when he's dancing, and that's through a mirror. And you really have to be paying attention. And I think these little tricks, these little techniques kind of keep you attuned to that. I can't say enough about James Laxton, who's the cinematographer on this project, the way that he communicates the identity of an incredibly taciturn guy, right? We have to feel like someone who doesn't talk. So how do we do that? We feel the sand in their fingers. We feel the wind on their face, the ice of the freezer in their face. This is a very like tactile movie, and a lot of that is communicated through the camera work.
Yeah, I don't know if either one of you, Sean or Lucy, have little moments that you were particularly in love with from this movie. One of them that Tom just made me think of, there's one kind of homoerotic scene on the beach at night, a deserted beach. And at the end of it, one of the two participants in the homoerotic scene, he just kind of drags his hand across the sand, you know, and it's like just somehow or other, this is like this incredibly vivid sort of telling moment. And, you know, yeah, go ahead, John.
No, I really love that that scene. I also love the scene with Little Chiron when they're playing Kill the Man with the Ball in the park. It's just like the intimacy. And that's what one of the things I loved about the tracking shots too, like the intimacy of the camera. A lot of times in films, when there's a tracking shot, it's used just because the novelty of like a particular type of shot, because like people like that kind of thing. But he uses it so well in terms of intimacy and like the intimacy and the handheld shot for that when – like I can't remember the other character's name. The love interest,
Kevin.
Yeah. But when they're kind of wrestling and he's telling them fight me, like you got to stand up for yourself, and like the camera is so close and it just like you can feel yourself in that situation. I remember being young and like fighting and feeling like someone's that close to me, and like you can understand how that relationship develops because like in that moment, like you don't it never feels forced, like that relationship. It seems so natural, and that's part, I think the camera work has a lot to do with
if that. I could just very quickly interject that scene, it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, the scrum on the football field. And it also, if you're so the camera work is great, but also underscoring that is Mozart. I mean, we hear Mozart as these kids, you know, playing with just a pile of paper. You know, it just speaks to this immensity of feeling that this kid has inside of him, such density of emotion and identity, and it just blew me away.
The music in the movie is really interesting. There's not a ton of music. There's that one use of Mozart. There's an original score that has some really beautiful thematic music that is used very judiciously and sparingly. And then there are about three or four pop tunes that pop up, including that Barbara Lewis tune at the end. I don't know, Lucy, I want to segue here, but is there one more thing you want to say about this movie?
Yeah. Just I was so struck by the use of water throughout the movie as a narrative device and as a device that really pulled this together. I don't think I can say enough things about how much Jenkins understands the cutting room floor and its importance in this movie. And so the juxtaposition that we get throughout water that's coming, you know, through the faucet in these housing projects, and specifically the image of the sink filled with water and ice cubes and the sound we get from that. And then the ocean, the expansive ocean, and the sound of the waves lapping at the shore and a body being in the water, or a body sort of just being on the periphery of the water. I was really, really struck by that.
Yeah. It's hard not to just fall completely in love with this movie. And really, every little choice seems to be so exquisitely cared for in this movie. And we're going to begin to annoy you if we go on and on.
Can I ask about potential point of criticism, just to get your take, Colin, about the Naomi Harris's depiction of the mother? I think when I was reviewing this movie on my show, the two women I was talking with said, this actually is a stereotype that we're seeing on screen. The crack-addicted mother who also kind of has a heart of gold, but actually can't, you know, get above it. I found incredible kind of pathos that performance, but in the depiction of, you know, the main female character here, did you think that was as true to the story and the person as the male representations?
I'll throw it back to the guests, although one, if not both, of the creators of this, I think it's based somewhat on Barry Jenkins's mother, isn't it?
It is.
I mean,
yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say that Barry Jenkins didn't get a crack addicted mother right if that's based on his mother. You know?
I think about that a lot of times when you see a depiction of a character and it's like stereotypical. You could argue that for a lot of characters. I think that's not unfair, but I think Naomi Harris did a good job. I think it's a real well done performance and a well done depiction of that, because like sometimes that is what that's like. Like sometimes stereotype. I understand like as a an artist, you kind of have to expand more on stuff like that. But like sometimes stereotype is a stereotype for a reason. You know what I mean? Like it's. I feel like. I didn't see anything inauthentic about that, because I know women like that. I know like people's parents who are on drugs, and it's this real struggle, and I see that in her. It's like she wants to be a good parent, but it's like you can't really escape that the pull of the drug on you. So I think one thing is the difficulty is like the movie's not about her, so you're not gonna get that much. You don't get that much in depth on any other character either. Like you don't get Janelle Monáe's character can be kind of seen as a stereotype in the sense that she's like that motherly figure, and it's like she says, she, like a lot of her lines are kind of cliche, but she does it. The movie does a good job, and she does a good job of delivering them to a point where you don't feel like, oh, I'm sick of this type of character, because she does it such a great job. I think that's my opinion on the whole movie, is like a lot of it can be seen as stereotypical, except for the fact that they just do a great job of hammering it home and making it feel like something new and something authentic.
Lucy, we have to talk about Jonathan McNichol's mother. Not really. And she doesn't, by the way, have a crack problem or anything like that. But she saw this movie and she really liked it. But she really liked it. And there's a way in which certain movies like this, and we're all contributing to this right now too, you know, certain works of art. I mean, Hamilton is probably the best example right now. You're not allowed to just like something. You know, like you have to have this other reaction to it. And you're really not allowed to not like it. And I've never understood that anyway, people sort of wanting you to embrace something at the level that they embrace it. But it does seem to go on. And I want to just say it's okay for Jonathan's mother just to like this movie. Do people ever try to bully you into their, you know, their aesthetic ecstasies?
Oh, yeah. I thought Hamilton was a really interesting kind of counterpoint to this, only because I was lucky enough to see it in October and loved the soundtrack. Totally obsessed with Hamilton. I like Broadway as a bigger genre. But I kind of felt after the first half like I could have walked out of the theater. I felt like the actors could have been going off stage and eating pizza between the numbers. And so I think people have not tried to bully me into liking something or not liking something, maybe short of like certain technological things that I really have an aversion to after spending the entirety of my day in a pint-sized studio around technology. And I hope that no one bullied Jonathan's kind and lovely and not crack-addicted mother either.
No, nobody should. But there is that kind of thing, right? I mean, like,
absolutely.
This,
I see that a lot, and I can understand the inclination to want somebody to like something as much as you. But if I ever feel myself doing that, it's more like I want you to appreciate the subtlety and the technique behind it. Not saying like you have to like it as much as me, but if I hate when someone dismisses something outright, because a lot of times it's just kind of a contrarian perspective. So it's like you dismiss it. Like you can't say, like if I see a movie like Moonlight, someone says, oh, that was garbage. How could you say that? Like there's so much, like if you don't like it, that's absolutely fine. You don't have to like it. But I feel like you have to at least appreciate what went into it. And it's not just another like piece of, so it's like I can understand why people, I try not to do it myself, but it's like I understand why, but you no one has, like I don't understand why people just can't be happy liking something and that's enough. You know what I mean? Like I know a lot of people that don't like Hamilton. I like Hamilton, and it's like I don't need to love it, and I don't need anyone else to love it or hate. Like just I can appreciate art on my own.
It's a news flash to me that there are people who don't like Hamilton. But
there's a lot of comedians people, on Twitter that they hate it.
I want to follow.
They're a critical bunch.
I mean, not that I don't like Hamilton, but no, there's some impulse like that. I mean, the example I gave is we're emailing around Bill Curry, with whom I actually saw Moonlight last night. Thinks I should like Leonard Cohen, and I don't like Leonard Cohen, and I'm never going to like Leonard Cohen. And like for Christmas, I'll get like an autobiography of Leonard Cohen, and maybe some kind of mixed CD of Leonard Cohen stuff. And I just like it never stops. And I don't like, I don't think I have ever done that with people. I mean, there's this great video from a little web series called Tiny Apartment. One of the episodes is about just people. Like it's a montage of about 117 people yelling at the two protagonists. You have to see The Wire, and like this reworded. They say it in different ways. You know, this is a little tiny girl who says it's an incredible fusion of urban drama and great, you know, it's like, you know. I don't know. Maybe that's time. That's just an instinct we have. You know, we love something, so we need it to be loved.
So there are a few different impulses there. I don't think there's anything insidious about wanting validation in terms of the art that you really respond to. As much as I totally agree with you, Sean, that art is something that, I don't know if we're going to that Adam Kirsch piece yet, but art is something that one responds to first and foremost personally. I mean, it is something that is a subjective experience, both in terms of its creation and its reception. And I have a show about movies in which I talk about movies every week. I love talking about movies with other people. I love getting their opinions. I try to articulate as well as I can why I like something, but if you don't come away like in it. That's not, I don't see that as fault of my own. However, in that Wire talk, and maybe we'll see this with Moonlight as well, I think there's a predilection from maybe the like cultural or economic elite to say, oh, now I understand poverty because I watched The Wire.
Yeah, definitely.
Let me tell you about, you know, the problems in the inner city of Baltimore. That is something that I think has nothing to do with art and just has to do with kind of smug, kind of easy understanding of something at a superficial level.
It's like the easiest form of cultural tourism. You know what I mean? You don't even have to go to the place. Like, you just say, oh, yeah, I saw The Wire. I understand it. It's like, you don't understand it. You understand this part of it. You understand, like, David Simon's vision of Baltimore, but you don't see... You're not getting the whole picture. So, like, when you don't expand outward from that and try to explore more of it, and you just use The Wire as your own, that's your frame of reference, that's the issue for me.
This is what I call, this is my phrase of the year, a cheap date with your conscience. So, Lucy, you get the last word about this.
Yeah, just very quickly, if I may. I think that we're seeing the confluence of two things, the incessant need for external validation and the sort of uptick in armchair activism, both of which are probably personified on Facebook more than anywhere else in the world. And so I think, you know, if someone says, well, I really want you to like this thing, it may be, I really want you to like this thing because I'm not sure if I am XYZ, if I like this or if I dislike this.
All right, we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about a different kind of art, a different kind of provocative art, and an essay that we read and were interested in. All right, Laurie Mack doing the breaks here. All right, so we're back. This is The Nose, and we have first of all, did I even say this? We're in the New Haven studios today, so that's why we sound so New Haven-y. And with us are Tom Breen, film critic for the New Haven Independent and the host of Deep Focus on WNHH, Lucy Gelman, a reporter for the New Haven Independent and station manager at WNHH, and Sean Murray, a stand-up comedian based in New Haven. This is his first Nose debut. We hope it is the first of many to come. So we're going to try to fuse two things here in this second segment. One of them is an art controversy that happened here in New Haven. And the other one is an essay that we read in Slate by Adam Kirsch. It's about kind of the challenge to art and intellectualism when something happens like the Trump election that seems to just defy gravity. I guess maybe to get this started, and Tom, I know you've been writing about this. So tell us about the cop pig art debate.
So every October, New Haven hosts this month-long celebration of local artists called Citywide Open Studios. And the gallery and kind of arts institution that organizes these celebrations is called Art Space. It's a gallery on Orange Street and Crown Street. Every year, so hundreds of artists around the city participate. There are venues all over the city. But the opening weekend for the past few years has taken place at the Gough Street Armory, which is otherwise a kind of an empty armory, but during this weekend in October is filled with hundreds of works of art. ArtSpace commissioned an artwork from a number of artists, but one from an artist named Gordon Skinner that they mounted on the periphery of the armory, including on a side street that looks out on the Whaley Prison. This artwork, called Cops, is a kind of mixed media work that includes a painting of a pig wearing a cop hat. The New Haven's director of Parks and Recreation, Rebecca Bombero, sent an email to ArtSpace saying, "Can you please move this? We've received a complaint from a police officer and a correctional officer that this is offensive. They don't understand the context in which it was placed. They see a city-owned building in the armory, and they think, why is there this such inflammatory imagery?" Gordon Skinner didn't want the picture put in the entryway to the armory. Instead, he wanted it put in the gallery space downtown, and he wanted a conversation with community members, with artists, with activists, and with police officers. That was about 2 months ago, and there have been a few conversations, and this upcoming Saturday, ArtSpace has resolved to remount the pig with the cop hat in its original location on the side of the Gough Street Armory, looking out over the Correctional Center.
So, I don't know, Sean... I've gone back and forth on this a few times, and I do have this little phrase that I will now sort of wear out my welcome here, and I have this little phrase, New Haven bubble, I sometimes say to myself, and sometimes when I'm reading about something like this, I think, well, this could be like one of these New Haven bubble stories, but on the other hand, it could be a really interesting debate about Yeah, I say it to Jonathan mainly. This could be really also a really interesting debate about the role of provocative art. I know, how does it play for you?
I find it it's kind of amusing just how I don't think it's unfair for a cop to be offended by that image, mm-hmm. but I don't see. I feel like when there's so much more going on socially, politically, that concerns cops' behavior, like something like that, it doesn't. I can't feel as bad for a cop seeing an image of a pig with a cop's hat and badge as I do for, like, because whenever there's a discussion about police brutality or something, that's something they bring up. It's like, oh, well, there was a thing where when Colin Kaepernick wore the socks with the pigs on him with the cops, and it's like, well, that's not, you use that as a moment to talk about the socks and not about the larger issue. And I feel like leave it up. I'm totally fine with it being up there, and you know what I mean, it's I feel like it's gotten the response that you would want out of it as the creator of it.
I read about it before I saw the likeness of it. It's actually a very happy looking pig anyway. It could be, it's kind of cute if they had like the village pigs and each one of them had like a different identity, like a construction worker and a cop or something. This would be the cop one, you know. But so Lucy, what's your take?
Oh, I'm going to be in hot water as a reporter for saying this, I think. But for me, as someone who is this lapsed art historian, this was much more about an institution, so i.e. art space, being interested in creating conflict where there wasn't that much conflict. So I don't think the piece should have been taken down. But I also think there needed to be more discussion with the people who lived in that community before the piece went up. That's really, really important. New Haven's not that big. It's a city of 132,000 people. It's okay to have a round table. In fact, I think the people of New Haven really enjoy community forums and round tables. And that's it's part of our blissful bubble, Colin.
Yeah.
It's something that we actually really enjoy. So I think then, after the piece was taken down, there was a question for me about why are you holding these events downtown and not in the Whaley Edgewood Beaver Hills section of New Haven, which there kind of is a specific, I think, racial and socioeconomic divide between those two neighborhoods. And so for me, that was more interesting. I think it's really good that ultimately, so last Tuesday, people from the New Haven Police Department and the New Haven Fire Department and the city art czar Andy Wolf came to ArtSpace and got involved in this discussion. I think the New Haven Police Department probably should have been involved in this discussion way before the fact, once the community was coming out. But I also kind of feel a little like this was just manufacturing controversy that ultimately took away from a lot of the other artists who exhibited in Citywide Open Studio. So almost 500 artists in New Haven exhibit over these sort of 3.5-4 weeks in October. And I hope they don't feel that their work was overshadowed, because a lot of them, including someone like Mohamed Hafez, are doing work that is inherently and much more powerfully political.
All right. Well, can we segue from this to the – so we read this piece by Adam Kirsch. It's in Slate. It's a I think it's a terrific essay. I don't agree with everything in it, but I think it's really provocative. It's what can artists do to oppose Trump? And he begins by saying, I think kind of provocatively, that the Trump victory has already put a number of complacent American assumptions to the test. Many things that liberal, educated people believed were cherished by all Americans turned out to be a matter of indifference to almost half of them. A free, objective press, respect for women, respect for the Constitution, common decency. One illusion that will be particularly painful to part with is the idea that high culture and the arts have any effective power in American life. I know, Sean, that was part of what you reacted to in this piece.
Yeah, to kind of bring it back to Hamilton, that was Hamilton's another a pretty exemplary of that, where I feel like what you would call the liberal elite, intellectual elite, like they feel like everyone has to connect to something the same way, mm-hmm. and it's like or even that if you connected to that, how could you have any other opinion? Where it's like sometimes you like something and you don't agree with the message of it, like the movie The Dark Knight. When you think about it, it's about the Bush administration, the Patriot Act, and all that stuff. Like when he's using technology to tap into everyone's phone. I love The Dark Knight. I don't agree that a one person should have that type of technology. So me liking The Dark Knight doesn't mean I approve of the Patriot Act and like government invasiveness. So I feel like I like the idea that I feel like maybe high culture doesn't have any effect on, and it's because so much stuff, even if something as big as Hamilton, is very niche in a sense that it's very coastal. Like people in flyover states don't, they'll never, most of them will never even get to see, they won't even be in the same city as like a place where Hamilton would, even like if it expands outward, they're not going to get to go to see Hamilton, so it doesn't mean anything to them in the same way.
You know, I mean, Tom, one of the arguments that Kirsch makes really well and powerfully in this piece is that there's a certain kind of storytelling, human-centered art has more power and more lasting effect than kind of statement art. So that, you know, the Jodes, there's some, you know, you could make a lot of statement art about poverty, about the plight of workers during a particular period of American history, but we'll remember the Jodes. We'll remember that story. You just have to see that name, and everybody knows exactly what you're talking about. He cites Pryor Walter in Angels in America as another kind of example of that. And I think you could say that Moonlight fits into that category pretty nicely too. That, you know, I couldn't exactly tell you what the political argument of Moonlight is, but I think we all felt a little bit altered anyway as a result of seeing it.
And I think something like Moonlight and the best kind of highly personal, highly specific art encourages something that has such profound political implications, and that is empathy. And that when art encourages us to better, I mean, I may have even mentioned this the last time I was on the show, but a mantra of Roger Ebert's was that movies were empathy machines. They encouraged audiences to think and understand the life experience of people that they simply were not. I mean, it's very difficult sometimes to understand what other people are thinking and experiencing. And movies at their best, not just through the story, but through the technique, can communicate that. The last time I was on the show, we spoke about Snowden, the latest Oliver Stone movie. And I think Stone represents a great example of someone who's made plenty of terrible political art and plenty of great political art. Snowden, I think, veered a bit more towards the terrible. But then something like JFK that I think is a really powerful piece. And what distinguishes the two is that character of Jim Garrison, played by Kevin Costner, in that we experience just the tumult and paranoia and disorientation of the military-industrial complex through this one guy who's discovering it, right? We see the personal implications and like almost the intellectual implications of this whole machine crumbling around him. In Snowden, it's too direct. I hate to say it, but it's too much. This is what Oliver Stone, the filmmaker, believes. These are the sins of America right now, and I need to make sure the audience comes away with the message I want. Art, as Kirsch argues, and as his hero Lionel Trilling argues, should be subjective. It should be kind of ambiguous. It's open to interpretation. I think that's what Kirsch is defending here when he says our hearts will always be with the Pryor Walters, even if power resides with Roy Cohn's.
Well, you know, Lucy, one of the other little sentences in this piece that really rung out to me, well, at one point, I may not be quoting him exactly, but Kirsch says something like, one of the things that may be the hardest thing to get used to is powerlessness, you know? And I do feel like we've just been through a period where, like, quote unquote, everybody said, no, you can't do this. No, I mean, like, you really can't do this, you know? I mean, and so whoever it is that you respect, whether it's David Remnick, you know, or Oprah, or, I mean, Oprah couldn't stop this.
Right.
You know, there's kind of a sense that nobody that we think has cultural power had any power to stop this from happening.
Yeah, well, and I think you even see people who were talking about, oh, now that, you know, Hillary has Beyonce and Jay-Z behind her, she's going to be okay.
That's right.
Which was sort of the very, very final leg before the election.
I'll see your Beyonce and raise you Scott Baio.
Right.
Anyway,
exactly.
Continue.
The most powerful man in Hollywood.
But I think what we're all sort of, the point that we're all sort of walking around or dancing around is the fact that you can be an artist and you can be an activist, but if you're going to do both at the same time, you really need to be doing it deliberately, and you need to be doing it with something, with a work of art that isn't maybe instant or maybe it is, but with something that's going to have staying power. And I think, you know, Tom, you were talking about Oliver Stone. I would say, you know, Laura Poitras is someone who cares very much, I think, about the art of filmmaking, but she does it as a means to political ends.
Yeah. I don't know. Sean, as we were emailing back and forth about this, you wrote, I thought this was a great reaction to the Kirsch piece, specifically about how intellectuals and artists have to realize that making art doesn't stand in for political action. That, you know, as Tom is saying and as Lucy's saying, you can do this at this really nuanced level. You can tell stories. I mean, I think if you got 10 million people to watch Moonlight, some of them would really be changed by it. But that's sort of not the same thing as political action.
Absolutely. I was going to try to get to that myself, because it's like writing a strongly worded letter is not the same as going down and like marching. You know what I mean? Like, it's at some point you have to do something, because Lucy was talking about armchair activism earlier. I feel like a lot on Twitter and Facebook is like, I'll post something and that's enough. And it's like, but did you go out and vote? Did you go out and like campaign? Did you go out and like actually do something in the community? Like, I feel like so much is like on a broad scale, like just saying go vote for Hillary, not Trump. And it's like, hey, we were talking about in the email thread, like by the time you say something like that, most people have made up their mind before they hear any song that denounces any candidate, you know what I mean? So a lot of times they'll take that as an affront. As someone who's a supporter of that, it's more of an affront to their point of view than it is a chance to see a different perspective. And I feel like at some point you can't just use your art as a weapon. You also have to go out and use, like, be a person who's not just an artist and go out and do something if you want to affect change. Because just saying, making a song where you say I don't think Trump's a good guy isn't enough. We all have heard that idea already, but what are you going to do beyond that?
Right. First of all, I have to quote Groucho now, who said in one of the films, I'm not in the habit of making threats, but there'll be a strongly worded letter in the Times about this tomorrow. So we have to break pretty soon, Tom. But I know I did say this in the email, although I didn't think of the most poignant symbol of this. There's no more poignant symbol than Chris Christie sitting at a Springsteen concert, right? He loves Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen is politically 180 degrees away from him. Everything that Bruce Springsteen is trying, to the extent that Springsteen is trying politically, which he's doing half the time, to get people to think and see and feel, is not necessarily what Chris Christie embraces. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't, because people, as Sean is saying, people are all pretty hardened off by the time they get to culture. You know, so I mean, they can just turn down the volume on the stuff they don't like.
Springsteen has been the perfect example for decades of that superficial proximity to a political perspective being like enough for politicians. Born in the USA being the most prominent example. I remember going to 4th of July celebration by Wilbur Cross a few years ago with Lucy, and they played Born in the USA probably 15 times in a row. And of course, to think about the song and its very strong anti-war message, it was a bit discordant with the explosions happening in the sky.
All right, we're going to take a little break here. We'll come back with some recommendations after this.
The devil and Sean Berryman, they took a walk together and they ended up on Washington talking to the river. He said, I surrounded myself with doctors and deep thinkers, the big heads and soft bodies make for lousy lovers. There was that night that we got
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Our intern today was Jumpy Fisher. The part of Bill Curry was played by Al Pacino. All of our episodes can be found at WNPR.org/Colin. On Monday, we're bringing back Colin's original conversation with Nancy Butler. Now, back to the nose.
All right, so we're going to recommend a few things to you. We'll start with Lucy Gelman.
Great. So I have two really quick recommendations. The first is a podcast. It's called Creative Equal, and Created Equal. It's out of WDET, which is the NPR affiliate in Detroit at Wayne State University that I grew up listening to. It's really good. It looks at the issues of race and inequality, often from a historical perspective. If you're a dork like me, even if you're not, try giving it a chance. And the other is a book. It just came out earlier in November. It's called The Fish Market, and it's by Lee Vandervoo, which is a great name. And it is about how maritime laws are changing both the phenomenon of overfishing and then also the economy on the seas for fishermen and what that looks like in terms of unemployment. It's something I had absolutely no idea about, and I feel much more well-informed after reading it.
All right. Tom Breen, you go next.
So as much I was thinking of endorsing a movie, since I talk a lot about movies, but this, I was so moved by this Adam Kirsch piece, I wanted to endorse an essay going back in the Wayback Machine that it reminded me a lot of. And that's a 1954 essay by the intellectual literary critic Irving Howe, and it's called This Age of Conformity. And at a time when he was really despairing that intellectual life in America had been completely subsumed by the victorious American bureaucratic machine, where intellectuals were becoming part of the universities and no longer offering kind of critical perspectives on something that they were supposed to be a little bit distant from, he gave this kind of call to arms. And I think it applies as much to people reading Adam Kirsch's article as his. And I just want to read the last sentence of the essay, which is, "The most glorious vision of the intellectual life is still that which is loosely called humanist, the idea of a mind committed yet dispassionate, ready to stand alone, curious, eager, skeptical." And I take those words to heart.
All right. Sean Murray, what have you got for us?
There's a podcast, a little bit more low culture than what you guys are doing, but there's a podcast by this comedian, Ian Carmel, called All Fantasy Everything, where they just basically fantasy draft anything in pop culture. So they did an episode with the cast of Airheads. So they're like works that they did, like what Steve Buscemi movie would you pick to get a top five? They did one on Candy. They did one on The Mall. It's really fun. They get a good group of like comedians and people. Like he had John Cryer on episode for a Candy episode. Mm. It's just a really fun way to just think about like, because sometimes, a lot of times, Ian will make a pick and he's like, I made this pick not because I wanted it so much, but it's just like, I feel like it had to be discussed. And it's an interesting way to think about how you would like pick things from pop culture. Sometimes you just want it to be spoken about more than you actually appreciate that thing. And this book, I can't even pronounce this guy's name. It's a Chinese science fiction writer. It's called The Three-Body Problem. I just read it. It's one of the first books I've finished in months because of school and work. But it's a really fascinating book about this an alien civilization coming in contact with humans. And there's a group of people who really want like the aliens to come down and like take over the world in order, because like they feel like humanity is lost in terms of like being able to govern ourselves. And there's a group of people who want like them to come, but just to get some of their technology. So it's a really interesting perspective on like who's right in that situation.
And what's the podcast called again?
All Fantasy Everything.
Yeah. And so you draft thing, you do like a draft.
Yeah, so he'll get like
I'm trying to decide which Steve Buscemi movie I would draft, you know. That would
So there's a film critic, Devin Faraci, whose kind of name's been not so, it's not a good name to have right now, but he kind of like cheated, and Steve Buscemi was on an episode of The Simpsons, so he took The Simpsons, and everyone was like, "Oh, that's a great pick. I never even thought to do that." Yeah. And he kind of like won. You don't win, but it's like they were like, "We feel like you won after you picked The Simpsons because you picked the greatest show in the history of TV."
All right, so I'm gonna endorse two books. One of them is called Some Luck by Jane Smiley. This is not a new book; it's out in paperback. It's been out for a while. I just happened upon it. It has this amazing narrative structure. It follows an Iowa farm family, a sprawling Iowa farm family, year by year, from I think sometime in the 1920s to maybe sometime in the early 1950s. And so each chapter is about maybe four pages long, and it's a year. As these people go through all of the wrenching moments of history that are contained in those years, the family sprawls out more, becomes more urban, encounters more different kinds of people. I don't know. I'm not doing it justice, but it's an amazing style of narration. Jane Smiley was on our show when we did historical novels, and I think I'd picked up the novel to read to get ready for that show, and I never did it. But then I read it, and it's amazing. And then also, Tana French, great Irish crime novelist, has a new book out called The Trespasser. Also, just absolutely terrific if you like that kind of thing. It's a detective story. I think it's one of her better ones. And I will now reveal that I am consuming it. I've almost finished it as an audio book. And so much depends on the reader, you know, and the reader who's doing this is really good. She's got the voice just right. So I'm excited to be able to recommend two books, because usually I haven't read anything except for the stuff that we do to get ready for the show. So thanks very much to Jonathan McNichol and his wonderful mother, and to whom we dedicate this show. We dedicate the show to Jonathan's mom. Thanks to Tom Breen, a film critic for the New Haven Independent and the host of Deep Focus on WNHH. Lucy Gelman, reporter for the New Haven Independent, station manager at WNHH. Sean Murray, look for him, stand-up comedian based here in New Haven. We got to get him up to Hartford to the CT Improv venue, too. Thanks for doing this today, guys, and we'll be back on Monday with the reprise of the Pastor Nancy Butler show.
You know, it's a very, very, very cool place to hang out. Yeah. It's cozy, like a Cracker Barrel. Yeah, we all be laughing, talking, joking, talking about this and talking about that. Talk about everything as a matter of fact. Oh.
like Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah, 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 yeah.